It's time for Gervie's Law, the intersection of law and life with your host, Alan Gervie. Alan is the managing attorney at the law firm of Rowan, Gervie & Wynn, a workers' compensation law firm which has represented injured workers for over 35 years. And now, here's your host, Alan Gervie.
Good evening. I am Alan Gervie, and this is Gervie's Law. I am so happy today to be joined by Leanne Tweeden, well-known TV and radio personality, been on the air longer than I've been born.
Hey, it's supposed to be the other way around.
I'm kidding.
I know. My kid still thinks I'm 29, so.
Well, you look 29.
Well, thank you.
You know, you've accomplished a lot.
I'm going to keep that going for as long as I can.
In your short time as an adult, you've accomplished a lot. And when you talk about accomplishments, that is a great segue for our guest today.
Yes.
Because he has accomplished so much. It's funny because I was reading an interview that he did, and someone was asking him about, like, how does he have this background as a security advisor? Was the 27th United States National Security Advisor from 2019 to 2021?
Yep.
And he reeled off all of the things that he had done previous to becoming a U.S. National Security Advisor. And it was just chock full of expertise and positions that
meaningful things too, not just fluff, meaningful things. I don't think the guy sleeps. That's my take.
So we're going to talk to Robert O'Brien today. He, as I mentioned, was the fourth and last person to hold the position of the U.S. National Security Advisor under President Donald Trump. He has since started American Global Strategies, which is a consulting firm that works with U.S. businesses interested in operating overseas. He advises on international politics, crisis management. He was the founder of the law firm of Larson O'Brien in 2016, and he still serves as, I guess, an of counsel with them. He has done so much in the area of national security. He is the recipient of the National Security Medal, the National Intelligence Distinguished Service Medal, the Department of Defense Medal for Distinguished Public Service, the National Defense Medal, the Legion d'Honneur, Chevalier for his work with Kosovo Presidential Medal of Merit. Mm-hmm. And he's not going to get a medal today being on Gervie's Law. But Robert O'Brien, we want to welcome you to the show.
Welcome, Robert.
Well, great to be with you both. Thank you very much.
Well, and you forgot to add, he was also special presidential envoy for hostage affairs with the rank of ambassador. And he also successfully negotiated the return of over 25 hostages and wrongfully detained Americans, which I always thought that was very interesting. I'm like, how do you get into hostage negotiating? But yes, that is Mr. Robert O'Brien for you.
Mr. Robert O'Brien, wow, she has a lot of respect for you.
Absolutely.
I guess you'd have to, just in case you're a hostage someday.
Oh, right. I'm calling him.
You used to do the USO tours and everything,
yes.
So you never know what's going to happen.
And I was always scared, you know. I'd always talk to my husband, Chris, when I was over there. I'm like, I'm going to stay on, you know, constant contact with you. And you know, I was shot at a few times in a plane, and I would always think about what happens if I landed in bad territory and we got separated from our group. But
I've never really thought that way. But, you know, obviously, yeah. Robert, you grew up with some interest at some point. What was the turning point when you went into it's so intriguing, you know, the espionage and the security and foreign affairs. When
Global,
did you really become interested in that?
Well, so thanks, Alan. I grew up interested in politics. My dad had been a Marine Corps officer, and so we always talked politics around the dinner table. And went off to UCLA and Berkeley and studied international law at UC Berkeley. And the Gulf War was just about to take place when I was graduating, so I joined the U.S. Army as a JAG officer and in the reserve. And I as I tell people, had an undistinguished career in the military, unlike Leanne's husband. And but it was great to just be able to put on the uniform and be part of the home team. I had a pretty conventional start to my career. I was a lawyer in Los Angeles at a firm in downtown, and A couple of years into it, I had the opportunity to go to Geneva and work on a commission deciding claims against Iraq arising out of Gulf One, and work for the UN Security Council, and that's kind of how it got started. But I always came back to L.A. and always practiced law. I had to earn a living as a litigator, and like you, Alan, and every couple of years when the Republicans took office, I had the opportunity to go into government and serve. So it's been a very blessed career, and had a wife and kids who are very supportive of me, you know, running off every couple of years to go serve the country.
I also noted that you had done some entertainment cases. I think you responded by saying, well, when in L.A., you know, do like L.A. lawyers. What was it that kind of dissuaded you from pursuing that kind of practice and getting more into something that's a little more esoteric and maybe not as popular in this city anyway?
Well, listen, I was doing entertainment cases, representing some of the big studios, but also producers and some celebrities right up until the time I left to be the hostage envoy in 2018. So that was always part of my practice. But I also had a portion of my practice was doing international arbitration. And so I'd spend about 15-20% of my cases were international cases. And I'd end up in places like Rwanda and East Timor and Kuwait and various places around the globe. Working on cases, sometimes for investors that had their property nationalized by a country, and sometimes representing countries that have been sued by investors. So that was always part of the practice. Never full time. I used to tell people if I'd been in Detroit, I would have litigated auto case, auto widget cases. But I was in Los Angeles, so there, most of our industry there is somehow related to the entertainment industry. So that's how I ended up doing a lot of those cases.
Now, just curious, when you talk about, being a special envoy and hostage affairs, and you're talking about going to countries that a lot of people don't even know where they are on a map, were you ever in a position where you were afraid for your life, or were you just, you're in a pretty posh hotel with security, or were you ever, was there any terrifying moments?
No terrifying moments. I always tried to be careful when I went places, but when I traveled as the hostage envoy, I always felt it was easier to be low profile, and so I'd usually go with myself or maybe one staffer and, show up in places like Algeria or various places in the Gulf or the Sahel. And in North Africa, we did have a special forces team that was with us in those trips. But, I always tried to be careful, but usually felt that being low profile was the best solution. And, I spent some time in an earlier job in the Bush administration and going back and forth to Afghanistan as we tried to promote the rule of law in that country. And that was always a little dodgy, but again, never came under fire, never had any, too difficult of an experience. But I was very, very grateful to be protected by U.S. special operators in most of those cases. And I always felt good in the hands of our soldiers, sailors, airmen, and Marines who look after diplomats when they're doing those missions. So, I've always, I've been to some interesting places and certainly some combat zones, but I've never come under fire, and I've always had, good security wherever I was traveling.
Have you ever felt that you were double-crossed by anyone, maybe because of a language barrier or maybe because people didn't have the same interests as you? I'll give you a quick story. When I was younger, I was in Cuba, and I happened to come across some medical students who were kicked out of medical school for some remarks they made about Castro, and I was interviewing them in a little tent. Someone had brought me to them to interview, and we had a great interview. And later on, when I was trying to leave the country, I was apprehended by security. Apparently, one of them had disclosed the conversations that we had, and they pulled me aside to try to get the tapes that I had used when I was videotaping them. Smartly, though, I had anticipated it. I gave it to a woman who was going back to Toronto, and she took the tapes. I told them what they were, but they didn't know how to get them, and I was released. But I know it was a harrowing experience, because when you have authorities coming after you, not trusting what you're doing, you get yourself in a little bit of a pickle. Did that ever happen to you?
Well, that was smart tradecraft, the way you sent the videotape song with the tourists going back to Toronto. So well done, Alan.
Thank you. I thought I was proud of myself.
Yeah, you could have a job working for another government agency.
Maybe I could. I could work for American Global Strategies.
There you go. Instead of litigating down in L.A.
But, correct.
I've had it happen in hostage negotiations where we thought we were at a deal, and then the other side would come back at the last minute, assuming that we were so desperate to get the hostage home. And look, we were always desperate to get our hostages home. When an American's held abroad, wrongfully detained by a government or held by a terrorist organization, you're heartbroken for them every day that they go through that experience, and certainly for their families that are here. So we were always eager to get them home. And there were occasions when our counterparties attempted to take advantage of that desire to get folks home and get more at the last minute or come back for some further negotiations. That's something we didn't countenance because it would have set a bad precedent. And when you're working for, as I was for Donald J. Trump, that was not how, if he had a deal, he felt he had a deal and the deal was getting enforced. And so there were a number of occasions where I had to explain to foreign counterparties when they came back at the very end saying, well, we thought we had a deal, but we need X. I said, that would be a very bad idea if you didn't follow through on the deal.
Wow.
I'll leave it at that. You can, but if you can't do it, you can't do it. But I'm going to go tell my boss what happened. And I'm not sure what he's going to do, but I don't think it's going to end well for you. And usually they withdraw the last minute demand and we get the person home. But
That's funny. A couple weeks ago, we had Lee Steinberg on, Super Agent Lee Steinberg, and he talked about negotiations the same way. You could be a general manager of a professional team. You could be an agent. You could be almost anything. It's crazy when you talk about negotiations. It's all the same.
Across the board.
All the same. We got to take a quick break. We'll talk more to Robert O'Brien after this. You're listening to Gervais Law right here on Talk Radio 790 KABC.
The glass is always half full when you're listening to Gervais Law on AM 790 KABC.
And we're back. We're speaking with Robert O'Brien. I'm here with Leanne Tweeden. And Robert O'Brien, of course, was the 27th United States National Security Advisor from 2019 to 2021 under President Donald Trump. Robert, I guess a lot of people will ask you this. How did that all come about when you were appointed the U.S. National Security Advisor? And was there an intense interview process, or did they just come to you and say, you're the guy?
Well, yeah, it's interesting. It wasn't something that I expected. I was working as a hostage envoy. I was over in Israel working on a case when John Bolton was terminated, resigned, whatever the whoever's side of the story you believe on that, but he left the White House, and I was flying back to California for the weekend to spend some time with my family, and my wife said, well, you may want to stop in Washington. I see you on all the lists for the National Security Advisor. I kind of chuckled and said, I'm always the Republican to be named later in trades, and they fill out the top 10 list with me at 8 or 9 to fill it out, but I don't think I'm up for the job. And so I was going to come home, and at the last minute, the flight was diverted and went to Washington, and the president called and his secretary called and asked me to come in for an interview, and had the interview, and obviously went well. And in California a couple days later at Jeff Palmer's house in Beverly Hills at a fundraiser, I stopped by to see the president, and he offered me the job. So it was it happened relatively quickly. I think the interview was probably determinative. The president asked how I viewed the job, and I said, look, Mr. President, I think you've had 3 national security advisors so far that have felt like it was their job to educate you on the world and implement their policies as national security advisor. I think my job as your national security advisor is to get you the best advice and options from the cabinet departments and agencies, and once you make a decision, make sure that decision is implemented. So I viewed the job in the more traditional role of a Brent Scowcroft or Condi Rice, and I think that's something that appealed to the president. So it was off to the races relatively quickly.
I'm sure it was, but probably you didn't answer the question in the interview that you ended up saying later regarding COVID-19 pandemic when you said to the president that this will be the biggest national security threat you face in your presidency. This is going to be the roughest thing you face. Now, if you would have said that in the interview, you know, I'm sure you would have gotten the job instantly. But that wasn't on the table. How did that change all of your plans and everything that you did say to the president in 2019, I assume it was, when you were interviewed?
Correct. Well listen, COVID-19 has changed the world and it changed everything that we faced in the White House. So in late December, early January, we started getting intelligence about this virus that was rampaging through Wuhan, in the Hubei province in China. And, you know, like communist governments do and you know, like the Russians did with the Chernobyl crisis, it was being covered up. But I had a deputy, Matt Pottinger, who had worked in China as a Wall Street Journal reporter earlier in his career, and he had contacts there. And we started getting informal calls from doctors in Taiwan, Hong Kong, and China, and realized that this was a really serious virus. At the time, you know, there were maybe 5 cases in the U.S. There were no deaths, and people thought it was going to be like SARS or something much less virulent than it turned out to be. But we were very concerned about it, and we were especially concerned about the Chinese efforts to cover it up. I mean, that was a red flag for us. And so I think it was January 28th, we were doing a national security briefing in the Oval with the president, and I think the position of most folks was that this will be something like, you know, SARS or avian flu, right, one of the prior pandemics that had come out of China. We, based on what we were hearing, we thought it was going to be much more significant. And I made that pitch to the president and really made a pitch that we close off travel from China immediately. And that was, you know, controversial. Folks didn't like it. But the president made the tough call and cut off the travel from China, I think, just 3 days later. And I think we saved a lot of lives because of it. But again, the COVID situation obviously changed how we operated in the White House, just the day-to-day operations, but also, you know, changed the dynamics of the economy and our national security posture. Everything changed with COVID in January of 2020. It was kind of remarkable series of events took place.
And I think we're still obviously dealing with it now, and maybe not pandemic phase, but endemic, but it's still affecting so much of the world and, you know, even the economy. And when you're in the administration like that and you're dealing with something and you're trying to look, obviously you don't know yet, but you're trying to look at the big picture, right? Are you fearing more that this could have, you know, breakdowns in the economy, which then trickle down, breakdowns in security? I mean, how do you look at it from that point of view at a White House level?
Especially given the fact that it's an unknown, that's
right,
something
exactly
that you have not dealt with.
Right.
Well, Leanne, it's a great question. Look, the thought is, your initial thought from the national security perspective is, how does this affect the military? How does this affect the sailors on our carriers,
readiness,
and destroyers and submarines? How does it affect our Marines, our soldiers, our airmen? What's our readiness going to look like? And so that was, you know, something we were immediately concerned about, because that's the first, you know, level of defense for this country, is to make sure that the military can deter our adversaries and protect us in the event of an attack. And so that's the first thing. But then, you know, this was such a society-wide problem, and we ended up having to have the short shutdown that prior to Easter of 2020, where the economy was, we shut everything down for about 2 to 3 weeks. Again, you know, in hindsight, maybe that wouldn't have happened, or maybe we would have handled it differently. But, you know, it was such a novel situation, and a pandemic of that magnitude we hadn't seen since the Spanish flu and, you know, the 1918 time frame. Mm-hmm. And so, we were doing our best as we went along and had a lot of good experts, and not everyone agreed on every issue. So, you know, our job was to try and you know, ferret through the issues and all the different advice and get the president the best advice. But it was a very difficult situation early on. Part of that was exacerbated, of course, by the Chinese that wouldn't let our doctors into China. We're lying to the WHO. The WHO, unfortunately, had become a bought and paid for subsidiary of the Chinese Communist Party. So, you know, we started out at a big disadvantage. This wasn't like this was a pandemic that started in Germany or the UK or an allied country that that there wasn't full transparency, and we could have known, for example, there was human-to-human transmission early on. I mean, we were told up until February by the WHO that there was no human-to-human transmission.
Wow.
And so, you know, this is – but when the history is written on this and the politics are taken out of it, folks are going to – China is not going to come out of this looking good. I think some of the things that we did that, again, that weren't, you know, credited to the Trump administration as the president, were Project Warp Speed with the vaccines. It was unheard of. You know, early in the crisis, we thought that ventilators were going to be key. I mean, you'll remember some of the early news stories that hospitals would have to establish boards to decide who could get the ventilators mm-hmm. when they came in.
That's right.
And it turned out that wasn't an efficacious treatment, but early on, they thought it was. And we were short on ventilators. And we stood up a ventilator manufacturing business like we did in World War II, literally using, you know, auto factory floors, and built 100,000 ventilators in 60 days. In fact, we had so many of them, we were able to give them to foreign countries. So all over the world, I was on the phone with the president, calling world leaders and asking, you know, who needed ventilators, and getting ventilators shipped out to Pacific Island countries, or we'd stick one or two on a Coast Guard cutter and give them out to a little island of the Pacific, to getting 1,000 ventilators to South Africa and Mexico and, you know, you name the country. And, you know, that was something we were able to do. No other country in the world was able to do it because of the ability of Americans to their ingenuity and their ability to stand up manufacturing. So when you look back at, you know, what was done in those early days, it was pretty extraordinary.
You know, one of the things that you did say was that the Chinese have lost credibility and it will be very difficult for them to overcome. Do you really believe that now when you look at the situation in the world?
Look, I do. I mean, the great threat that we face to the country and to our way of life is the Chinese Communist Party. And the Chinese people are terrific. They're hardworking. They're smart. They're great folks. They're some of the greatest immigrants in American history have come from China. So we're, you know, they're terrific people. But the Communist Party that governs China is totalitarian, Marxist-Leninist. They put together a total surveillance society, the likes of which we've never seen. Everything is measured and videotaped and recorded in China. Every Chinese citizen has something called a social credit score, which shows, you know, it shows the party how trustworthy they are and how much the party can count on them. And the Chinese want to do that to everyone in the world. I mean, they're certainly doing it to all the elites in countries around the world, but they want to control us. And you don't have to look any further than the Houston Rockets general manager, who put out a tweet that in support of the Hong Kong protesters, and all of a sudden the Houston Rockets were off TV in China, and the NBA was groveling to the Communist Party. So, you know, long answer to your question, Alan, but look, I think that China's wielded a lot of power. A lot of Wall Street's made a lot of money on China, certainly the film industry, the gaming industry. But I think that COVID-19 and now the Ukraine situation, where China's backed Russia as an unlimited partner, has opened the eyes of many Americans who realize we don't want our supply chain starting in China. We don't want to have to get our critical pharmaceuticals. We don't want our computer chips. We don't want all the things that make this economy go and this country great to be sourced from China. We want to start manufacturing again here in America, or at least have our friends manufacturing it. So I think there's been a sea change in the way people look at China. We're not going to decouple from China overnight. And there are, you know, China has a lot of friends. They spend a lot of money here, and they've got ideological friends here. So they'll continue to exert influence. But I think the consensus on China has changed dramatically over the past couple of years, and COVID's been part of it.
As you say that, though, thinking that perhaps there was more trouble coming from China, do you think sanctions are going to be a viable option, or is that going to turn the world upside down?
You know, sanctions are always tough. It's tough to implement them. And it's tough to get the desired results. And we're seeing in Russia, for example, there were pretty massive sanctions on the Russians. We put a lot of sanctions on the Russians during the Trump administration. But at the same time, because oil prices have gone so high during the war, Vladimir Putin is making more money today off his war because of the high oil prices, and he's losing on sanctions. And so the Chinese are looking at that and seeing Putin turn a profit on this war in Ukraine, which is, you know, terrible. Because we haven't put full sanctions on the Russians. We haven't cut off oil and gas sales, and And until we do that, we're not going to change Russian behavior. So in crafting a sanctions package against China, you know, it's going to be tough because China's a big country. It's got a massive economy, second biggest in the world, very close in size to ours. And so it's going to be hard to shut them down with sanctions alone. That would be one tool that we would use to deter them, for example, from invading Taiwan. But again, it's not going to be the determinative tool. And you can only use sanctions if you, they're only efficacious for so long if we've sanctioned the Russians and the Chinese and the Iranians and the Venezuelans and others. At some point, you know, they lose their sting. So we've got to be careful with how we roll them out.
And I think also to borrow from a sports analogy, you have to expect there's going to be a response. Any offense, you're going to have a response. So that creates the uncertainty that makes it even more risky when you talk about the sanctions. We got to take a quick break. We're talking to Robert O'Brien. I'm Alan Gervey. She is Leanne Tweeden. And you are listening to Gervey's Law right here on Talk Radio 790 KABC.
Welcome back to Gervey's Law, lifting Murphy's Law to the highest level on AM 790 KABC.
We are back. I'm Alan Gervey, and we are talking to Robert O'Brien, former U.S. National Security Advisor and one of the founders of the American Global Strategies, a consulting firm that we will talk about in a little bit. Before we get to that, Robert, let's just talk about your experience in the Trump administration. You've been quoted as saying that Trump was laser focused on issues at hand and asked probing questions. You were almost comparing it to a litigation situation where someone was aware of all the facts and the evidence and should not be criticized for not knowing what is going on. You were there. What made you make that comment, and how do you deal with the naysayers saying that that wasn't the case with the president?
Well, look, I was with him every day, and so I would brief him 4 to 5 times a day as issues arose, and then we'd have our formal Oval Office intelligence briefings when the CIA briefer would come in, and then Gina Haspel, the Director of National Intelligence, and the Vice President would be there with us for the Chief of Staff for those briefings. And I'll tell you, the President had tremendous instincts when it came to foreign policy and national security. He also had very good instincts when it came to intelligence, because part of the issue with intelligence is, you know, you've got to analyze it. You pick up something on the wires, or you pick up something electronically, or you have human intelligence that provides you with a report. Then you've got to figure out, you know, how valuable is it? Where does it fit in the jigsaw puzzle of everything you're focused on? And the president always had very good instincts on those issues. And, he knew the world. He knew that he spent a lot of time talking on the phone with world leaders. So he had his own sources of information. And so my experience with him always is that he was, you know, well prepared to address any issue that we brought to him. And again, that wasn't something that was popular in the press or in the news. But, you know, what I like to tell people is look at the results. I mean, you had the historic Abraham Accords, which are unprecedented peace in the Middle East. And, you know, the president didn't get the credit he should have for that. You saw Serbia Kosovo, which has been at war for years, entering into an economic normalization agreement with their leaders in the Oval Office. You saw us get Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, a very daring raid to bring justice to the leader of al-Qaeda who killed Kayla Mueller and Jim Foley and Peter Kasich and Stephen Sotloff and all Americans, young Americans. You saw the increased NATO spending that we achieved at the summit in December of 2019, which is now paying dividends with the current crisis in Ukraine. You saw us change the consensus on China, and then you saw Operation Warp Speed. So those are just a few things that I was involved in as the president's national security advisor in the last kind of year and a half of the administration. We continue to bring hostages home, which we got started a little bit earlier. So when you look at that record of accomplishment, it doesn't square with the kind of a mainstream press image of President Trump being disengaged on foreign policy and national security. In fact, it suggests just the opposite.
Do you find that with President Trump, that the people who, you either love Trump, I believe, or you really hate him in this country? I mean, there's really not a lot of middle ground, I think, with Trump supporters or Trump haters. But I think when people, we were talking with, on some past shows, how people look at the world, and it doesn't matter what the facts are or what, so much emotion is involved, right? And when people, you say Trump, and it evokes this emotion, and it doesn't matter the good he's done, they go, but this, but that, and he says these things that are kind of brash, and I think that put a lot of people off. How did you deal with that? He would say things, and they might have been right, but the way he said them rubbed people the wrong way, so they wouldn't get the message he was trying to say a lot of times. How would you deal with that when you had to work with him in the Oval Office?
And before you answer that, Leanne, I think you're referring to last week's guest, who was Alan Dershowitz.
Yes.
And Alan Dershowitz talked about that.
And representing him,
In representing in the case against not impeaching him and all of that. Kind of what Robert's saying, he was saying that, maybe he didn't get a fair shake.
Well, look, the president has his, his persona, and he's a New York real estate developer, and he grew up, Fred Trump, his dad, was a tough guy, and unlike a lot of wealthy kids, he did not grow up with a silver spoon in his mouth. He grew up on the construction projects on his dad's apartment complexes and office buildings that were being built. And he grew up with a bunch of World War II immigrant veterans and tough guys from Queens and the Bronx. And that's his persona. And it's a little different than my persona, for example, or Alan's or Leanne's or Alan Dershowitz's. But, the things that allowed President Trump to get the results that he did on some major issues, and again, the Abraham Accords is something historic, the toughness and the bluntness that allowed him to prevail in those negotiations are also some of the characteristics that would turn people off or think, people would think they weren't entirely polite, spoken, in another context. So you get the whole package. And I think overall, when historians look at the Trump presidency and the Trump administration divorced from some of the political polarization that we're going through right now as a country and divorced from some of the emotions that Leanne talked about with the president, you're going to see a different interpretation of the record than the immediate reaction that we're seeing today. And let me give you just one example. Every presidential candidate from the major parties, I went back and looked at the actual campaign pamphlets and platforms going back to Jimmy Carter since I was involved in politics. Every president has said that Europe has to pay its fair share when it comes to defending America and defending democracy and defending Europe. But America has always covered the defense of Europe, and it was never seen as fair by the American people, the American taxpayers. And every president said it, including my heroes of mine, like Ronald Reagan. But no president ever got the Europeans to pay their fair share. And in going to the summit in 2019, the president was really his language rough on the Europeans. Say he was he questioned whether Article 5 was still something we should be care about. Should we come to the defense of Europe if Europe's not going to defend itself? Should we keep our troops in Germany if Germany's not going to pay its fair share? Why are we spending all this money on defense when the Germans are spending $1 billion a day on energy from Russia and helping Vladimir Putin build his war machine? So he was saying all these uncomfortable things, and there was a lot of hand-wringing in Washington among the foreign policy elite. And he's undermining NATO, he's undermining our alliances, this isn't how America acts, this is what we do look terrible. And the bottom line is I had to do the negotiations. I was with Jens Stoltenberg on the phone or in person every day, and the Secretary General of NATO. And at the end of the summit, we walked away with, I think we went from four countries that were paying 2% of their GDP towards defense to 11. And we had $400 billion over 10 years in additional defense spending secured from our European allies.
Wow.
So the result was historic. It never happened before that the Europeans stepped up to start burden sharing with us. Not only that, they sent more troops to Afghanistan and Iraq. And so it was really quite an accomplishment. And yet the story out of the NATO summit was the president was brash or rude or, you know, America wasn't being a good ally. And yet I was just in Europe meeting with current national security advisors in a number of countries in Eastern and Western Europe. Every one of them thanked me for the fact that we put pressure on them to increase our defense spending, because some of the arms purchases that they've made over the last 2 years as a result of our pressure has allowed them to send weapons to Ukraine and be better prepared for the Russian threat that they face now. And a number of them, including them, had German politicians who said, look, we hate to see you. You've been very nice to have it, so I told you so, but you guys were right on Nord Stream 2. You were right on defense spending. You were right on troop levels. We were wrong, and we appreciate it. So, but that's not a story you'll hear on MSNBC or in the mainstream press these days.
Well, that's why you're on this show.
Yes, exactly.
Having said that, Robert, where do you see the differences in the current administration's approach to security and foreign policy? Do you spend your days cringing now, having had the experience that you just discussed?
Well, look, I don't cringe. And these are very tough issues that the Biden administration is facing. I mean, I jokingly tell people I knew a lot more about national security the day before I was national security advisor. And I got all that knowledge back the day after I was national security advisor. And when you're in the middle of it, you know, you're doing your best to deal with, you know, very, very serious situations. And the safety of America is in large parts in the president's hand. And you're there assisting the president to make sure that our country is safe. And it's, you know, the things that you're very sure about, prior to being in office, you may not be so sure about when you're facing the real life events. So, I keep the president, President Biden, and Jake Sullivan as national security advisor, and Tony Blinken and Lloyd Austin in my prayers. And as an American, I've got two daughters who are in the service, and I hope we get great leadership. In some ways, they've kept many of our policies in place, certainly with China. And in Europe, and they've done some good things in rallying the Europeans in response to the Russian invasion of Ukraine. There are other areas. The withdrawal from Afghanistan was a catastrophe. It was not how we would not have handled the withdrawal that way, and I think everyone in the world knew it. That was there were some major blunders there. Certainly the really begging Iran for a new nuclear deal. When the Iranians, violated the first deal and had been racing towards a nuclear weapon, and we ended the JCPOA, but there's this desperation in negotiating with the Iranians that I've never seen before to get a new JCPOA, and so that's an area that we're certainly concerned about. And then dealing with China, the Chinese are putting a lot of pressure on to have the tariffs lifted. Claim that it'll help with inflation here and that sort of thing. I don't think that's true. And I think it'll just be a gift to Beijing. So I hope that the tough sanctions the tough tariffs that President Trump put in place, because the Chinese were being unfair in the way they dealt with us, stealing our intellectual property and violating trade rules and dumping things here. We put those tariffs in place, and it's helped. So, there's some things they're doing well. There's some things that we would have certainly handled differently. Well, but as an American, we hope for the best. So.
Well, you may get a chance to turn this around, and we're going to talk about that after the break. The future for Robert O'Brien. You're listening to Gervie's Law right here on Talk Radio 790 KBC.
Welcome back to Gervie's Law, lifting Murphy's Law to the highest level on AM 790 KABC.
All right, we're back with Robert O'Brien, American Global Strategies, a consulting firm. But before we get to talking about that and the future for Robert O'Brien, we don't know the future for ourselves,
right.
But we can think about the future. I heard in the past, Leanne, that you actually had the pleasure of having dinner with Robert and his wife.
Yes, we've actually seen them a couple of times around the area that we live in, and we've had ice cream, and we've had dinner, and his lovely wife, Lo Marie, and his two daughters, beautiful, intelligent, serving our nation, and, you know, you couldn't have asked for a better family to sort of, you know, the quintessential Americans that serve, that are proud of this country, and it's just a real honor and privilege to
know
them.
So are you going to have an opportunity perhaps in the future to say that you had ice cream with the President of the United States?
I don't know. We're going to have to ask Robert O'Brien that himself. So Robert, of course, you know, you can't read anything with your name attached to it out there, and, you know, not knowing what's happening for 2024, and that your name is thrown around as a potential dark horse as a candidate for the President of the United States.
Wait a second. Did you say dark horse? You got to think positive.
Well, I'm just saying what the reports have said.
We don't know who the front runners are right
now.
That's
exactly right. I mean, a lot of people are still saying Trump and throwing his name out there, but what do you say to that? Can you tell us?
Thank you, Leanne. And listen, you're right back at you as far as your family goes, and your husband's a great American and senior officer in the Air Force. And
thank you. And
you've been around the world cheering up our troops in you know, dire circumstances, and you know what it means to them to on a holiday or you know, especially at those forward operating bases where you show up with your colleagues from the entertainment world and bring a little message from home. So thank you for all you've done with the USO, with all they do to raise the morale of our troops, especially the ones who are, you know, stationed overseas on the front lines of freedom. So thank you for that. And Alan, you're doing your job to keep the rule of law rolling here. I tell people if I could have a few LA plaintiffs lawyers to negotiate deals for the U.S., we'd do a lot better sometimes than we would with some of our folks in Washington.
Right.
You deal with more tough negotiations in a week doing your workers' comp.
Oh boy! But you know, I'm fighting the good fight.
You get plenty of hostages out with the experience.
You said that.
You can tell I'm avoiding the question.
You are avoiding it.
But you're wait a second.
Don't worry.
Wait. I got to tell you, this is perfectly presidential. He's avoiding the question,
right,
but he's doing it in such an eloquent and diplomatic way. I mean, by complimenting people, saying how great.
We're like, oh, that's so nice. Thank you.
Well, let's make it more of a softball question. Why don't you talk about your vision and where you see the party going? Moving forward, and what your part might be.
Well, listen. What I've been spending my time doing is going around the country and meeting great Americans, and not for any personal ambition, but just to make sure that we elect a Republican Congress. I want to see my friend Kevin McCarthy, who's a fellow Californian, and I think you both know Kevin. He's just a terrific guy from Bakersfield. I'd love to see him as the next Speaker of the House, and so I've spent a lot of time helping his candidates, including some in California, like Young Kim and Michelle Steele. And we've got this diverse slate of candidates of women and veterans and African-Americans and Hispanic candidates running all over the country. It's when you talk about a vision of the party, it's a big tent party. On the Senate side, I think we've got some great opportunities to pick up seats. I think Adam Laxalt, whose grandfather, Paul Laxalt, was Ronald Reagan's best friend and former governor of Nevada and senator from Nevada. I think Adam's going to win that race. I think Blake Masters has a real shot in Arizona. So I think we've got some terrific Republican candidates in both the House and the Senate. I'll try to go out and assist them to the extent I can and raise some awareness for their candidacies. But I think you're going to see a real sea change. I think you're going to see a 30 to 40 seat Republican majority in the House come November. No matter what happens, you know, between now and then, the gas prices aren't coming down because the president won't finish the Keystone Pipeline. He won't allow leases on federal land for oil and gas exploration. He's demonizing gas station owners. And, you know, you guys probably know some gas station owners. I do. Those guys don't make much money, and they work really hard, and they're getting demonized. So I think you're going to see, you know, as you know, what my daughter goes, Dad, it was $100 to fill up my tank. You know,
wow.
You know, kids can't afford it.
No.
Young people who are just starting out, making $60,000-$70,000 a year. They can't afford to fill their tanks and commute to downtown LA and go to their jobs because of the gas price. So I think the American people are now fed up with the situation. So I think you're going to see some opportunities with the new Congress of less regulation, less taxes, more oil and gas production. I think America's going to have a renaissance. And then I think in 2024, there are a lot of great candidates. And of course, President Trump may run, and he'd be certainly the front runner if he ran again. But you've got others. If he decides not to run for whatever reason, you've got Governor DeSantis, Governor Youngkin in Virginia, the new governor there, Governor Abbott in Texas. You've got my former colleague and friend Mike Pompeo, the former Secretary of State. You've got Nikki Haley. You've got a terrific senator from South Carolina and Tim Scott. You've got Rick Scott, you've got Marco Rubio, you've got Ted Cruz. So on the Republican side, the bench is incredibly deep. And I think you're going to see a lot of candidates, especially if President Trump does not get involved in the race, you're going to see a lot of candidates that get involved in the race and a lot of good candidates.
You know, I think you've said it well. America probably looking for change and at least some improvement. Unfortunately, the times have not been great. And it made me think when you were talking about all the work you're doing now without saying anything about maybe your aspirations. But I'll tell you an old Canadian maxim, and that is that a speed skater doesn't go into speed skating to have huge muscular legs. But after skating for 10 years, they have huge muscular legs. And I think that you're doing it right with everything you're doing. And who knows, in 10 years from now, you may be the man.
Well, that's very flattering. Thank you, Alan.
We're going to have to end it here. I'm still, fascinated by all of these issues because there are so many. And I know Leanne's looking at me right now.
I'm like, I have more questions I could ask, but I know
we'll have to bring Robert back maybe as the year goes on and see how things are going, whether gas prices are still as high. It's horrible to
think. California keeps adding more taxes on top of it.
It's crazy. But
it's
let's definitely do it again. I'd love to come back and spend some time with you, Alan and Leanne. It's been a great conversation.
All right. Thanks very much, Robert. Take care.
Best to the family, okay?
God bless you both.
Thank you.
You too. All right. Well, that is going to wind up another Gervie's Law episode.
How's the frog? Did he leave?
I'm sounding good. I feel good.
That's great. Thank you
for sharing your friend Robert O'Brien with us.
Absolutely. My
pleasure. Appreciate that. All right, thanks for listening, and we will see you next week.